the latest edition of her book, Herbs for Children's Health. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday morning radio zine.
Hi, this is John Schuck, host of Religion for Life, with a warning. Progressive Christianity is dangerous, and it will send you to hell. That's the message of clergy in Fountain Hills, Arizona. They've ganged up on Progressive Minister David Felton in a very public way. David talks about his response this week on Religion for Life. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is streaming, podcasting, and archived at madnessradio.net. Welcome to our new broadcast station, KBOO, in Portland, Oregon. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is Will Hall. Today, our guest is Dr. Terry Coopers. Terry is a psychiatrist in Oakland, California. He's a professor at the Wright Institute. He's the author of 4 books, including Prison Madness, The Mental Health Crisis Behind Bars, and What... What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is streaming, podcasting, and archived at madnessradio.net. Welcome to our new broadcast station, KBOO, in Portland, Oregon. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is Will Hall. Today, our guest is Dr. Terry Coopers. Terry is a psychiatrist in Oakland, California. He's a professor at the Wright Institute. He's the author of 4 books, including Prison Madness, The Mental Health Crisis Behind Bars, and What We Must Do About It. Terry is a frequent expert witness in class action litigation around prison condition issues, sexual abuse of prisoners, and prison mental health, including a recent $100 million victory in Michigan about women prisoners who were sexually abused while incarcerated. So welcome to Madness Radio, Terry Coopers.
Hello, glad to be with you, Will.
I'm really excited to have you on the show. This is such an important and really tragic and disturbing issue to talk about, mental health in prisons, and I really appreciate you being on the show. I really encourage people to check out your excellent book, Prison Madness, The Mental Health Crisis Behind Bars and What We Must Do About It. Just to get started, let's maybe talk a little bit about the prison crisis in general in the United States, because the U.S. incarcerates people at a rate much, much higher than any other country on the planet. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct, and by far. We now, the prison population has multiplied by 10 since the early 1970s. We now have about 2.5 million people behind bars in jails and prisons, and that's far surpasses our closest competitors were the Soviet Union before it broke up and South Africa before the end of apartheid. Those two countries are now imprisoning many, many fewer than the United States. So we're out in the lead all by ourselves.
And that's a terrible comparison because South Africa under apartheid and the Soviet Union are, of course, very repressive, abusive dictatorships. So we're really in a prison crisis in the United States. What is it that's been driving the prison population to grow to such an extraordinary level? Because it wasn't always like this in the United States.
Well, there are many factors. I think one of the central ones was the war on drugs. In the 1970s, we just decided to lock up everybody who had any involvement with substance abuse, which is absolutely foolhardy, because what we know is that people who have a substance abuse problem when they go into prison are going to have a substance abuse problem when they come out. So it's an absolutely worthless intervention. But we started imprisoning people one after another, and that multiplied the prison population many times over. That then caused crowding, which we know with crowding, there's more violence, more psychiatric breakdown, and more suicide in jails and prisons. So those figures kept rising. And meanwhile, out in society, people were saying, stop coddling the prisoners. We need longer sentences. There was truth in sentencing, three strikes, mandatory minimums, that kind of thing. So what kept happening is that the prison population kept ratcheting up. None of the changes since the 1970s have decreased prison populations. Meanwhile, we've been locking up more people for more varied reasons, and the population has grown, the prisons have become overcrowded, and they've really become out of control.
And there's really been no decline in the drug problem in the United States as a result of the war on drugs. Our war on drugs policy has been a complete failure. And the policy change really took place, like you said, in the 70s. And it seems like there was a big race and racism element here because of so much anxiety after the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement, changes in society. There was a lot of turmoil. And the impact of the, I have some statistics here, the impact of the prison changes and now the huge number of prisoners was primarily felt among African Americans and Latinos. So it's really a race issue. Today, 70% of prisoners are African American and Latino in the United States.
That's correct. It's shocking. When you walk into a jail or a prison, you see the racism of our history. You see the history of slavery. 50% of prisoners are African American, another 20-25% are Latino and Native American. And that's outrageous. And you see it in every area of the prison. For instance, if you go to the solitary confinement units, the punitive segregation, they're mostly people of color in there, African American and Latino. If you go to the programs that are highly desirable, like training in vocational skills, and there are a few of those left, although there are less today, you'll see mainly white prisoners. So you see the racism by the proportion of people of color in prison, and then also by what's done with them when they're in prison.
Let's talk about that, Terry. You have described the current U.S. prison system as really a throwback to the kind of snake pit mental asylums that we had in the 1940s and 50s with just absolutely rampant abuse and violence and really horrible conditions for people that actually make people crazy and traumatize people. Let's talk a little bit about that. You've written really eloquently about that comparison. What is it that prisons do to people given the kinds of conditions that prisons are under in the United States today?
Well, let me back up a step and say that while all this was going on in the prisons, the public mental health system was being dismantled. So if you compare the proportion of resources in the public sector that go into mental health treatment programs, it's been declining steadily since the early 1970s. And what this has meant is that a lot of people don't get quality mental health care in the outside world. Also, they don't get housing. So there's a disproportionate number of people with emotional problems among the homeless. They all then tend to get locked up. So what we've got now is a situation where there's more people suffering from mental illness inside jail and prison than anywhere else. The hospitals are small, the state hospitals in comparison, and an awful lot of people with mental illness go to prison. Then in prison, there are conditions that make mental illness worse, and that's what I think we need to talk about. The crowding itself. We know from very good research that with crowding, the incidence of violence, the incidence of mental breakdown, and the incidence of suicide all rise precipitously. So by crowding the prisons as we have with this 10-time multiplication of the population, we've basically exacerbated or even caused serious mental illness. Then in the 1970s, there was a historic, what I call a historic wrong turn in corrections. The rehabilitation programs, what existed, were basically dismantled. And they were dismantled because of the call by conservative legislators and politicians that wanted not to coddle prisoners or to be tough on crime and things like that. So they started taking apart the rehabilitation programs, the education programs, and that kind of thing in prison, leaving an awful lot of prisoners idle. They kept crowding the prisons, so the number of people crowded into a yard increased. In California, the gymnasiums that used to have basketball courts and volleyball were filled with bunk beds. In California, they're three high, so that you get 150 to 250 in the men's prisons, 150 to 250 men in a, what used to be a gymnasium. They can't be supervised. There's just too many people. There's a lot of violence. There's a lot of rape.
So the studies show clearly that any conditions that you put people into that are so crowded, the crowding conditions themselves lead to increased aggression, increased stress, increased violence, increased trauma, and increased emotional distress, which is, of course, what we're talking about when we're talking about mental illness.
Absolutely. And then the people with mental illness get the brunt of the burden. Think about a phone booth inside of prison. There's few enough of them so that prisoners have to wait in line. If there's more prisoners, there's more of a tendency for the prisoners in line to say, hey, you're taking too long on the phone. And then that leads to a fight. So there are more fights. There are also a large number of people with mental illness in prison, and they tend to get victimized in the fights. So it's sort of a double whammy. What happened in the 1980s is that with massive crowding and therefore violence, mental breakdown, and suicide rising, and with the dismantling of the rehabilitation programs, the prisons were out of control. There were what were called riots, and many of the riots were actually organized protest by prisoners to demand more human conditions. But in any case, the prisons were noticed to be out of control, and they could have made a correction to their foolhardy ways. They could have reinstated the rehabilitation programs and cut down on the crowding.
So this was a wave of protests by prisoners that got spun by prison authorities and the media into rioting dangerous prisoners.
Absolutely. There was some violence on the part of prisoners, but actually there was more meaningful protests that got, you know, interpreted, spun as a riot. And said, we've been wrong, we need to reinstate the rehabilitation, and we need to cut down on the crowding. By, for instance, low-level drug offenders don't need to be in prison. We could do something with them out in the community. Then they would have corrected the problem, and the violence rate would have gone down. Instead, they resorted to solitary confinement, and that is super maximum security segregation units, where prisoners would be alone in their cell for nearly 24 hours a day. That was in the 80s, the advent of the supermax prison. And since then, over 40 states and the federal government have built them. These are huge institutions composed entirely of segregation cells where people are alone, idle, they have very little to do. There's no programming, there's no rehabilitation, there's almost no educational opportunities in these places, and people just sit in their cells. Mumia Abu-Jamal said, think about being locked in your bathroom for years, and that's what it is. People are just locked in a little space in a cell, and the only human contact they have is with the guard, who's often gruff with them and hands them a food tray. And that is the new kind of prison environment that, in fact, we discovered quickly causes or exacerbates mental illness.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and we're speaking with Terry Coopers. He's a professor at the Wright Institute and author of four books, including Prison Madness, The Mental Health Crisis Behind Bars, and What We Must Do About It. It's often when we hear the word mental illness, the kind of the association is, oh, that the person has something wrong with their brains, it's genetic. But you're actually talking about how the conditions that are in prisons lead to trauma, lead to emotional distress, lead to the symptoms that get interpreted and diagnosed as mental illness. And of course, a lot of people who are ending up in the prison system have a pre-existing history of trauma. And we know that there's a relationship between poverty and racism and trauma.
Yes. I think what we're talking about, the social psychologists call it an attribution error. If you take just an average person and put them in a certain situation, changes will happen. If you then, you can attribute the changes to a characteristic of the individual or to the situation they've been put in. And when prisoners are put in severe isolation, which is what I'm describing as the supermax prison, the average person will break down and go through a series of emotional anguishes and despair. And it's not because inherent in that individual is a proclivity to break down in that way. Rather, it's because the conditions are so extreme. The best research to demonstrate that is what's called the Stanford Mock Prison Experiment. This was done in the early 70s by Philip Zimbardo, Craig Haney, and a group of researchers. And what they did is they took Stanford students as subjects to the basement of the psychology department, identified half of them as prison guards and gave them the keys and the food. And the other half they called prisoners and they locked them in rooms. Everybody now is a Stanford student. So there's nothing, these are not antisocial or criminal type people.
These are just volunteers who are playing the roles in being that institutional setting of prisoner or prison guard.
That's correct. So the experiment was supposed to go on for 2 weeks. They were going to study the behavior of guards and prisoners, but they had to stop it in less than 2 days because of the degree of sadism and cruelty that had broken out, where the students who were guards were abusing the students who were prisoners. They were withholding food. They were turning out the lights in the daytime. They were just totally abusing them. And the implications, if you think about it, this is a Stanford experiment with Stanford students while professors are watching. But if you then move to the prison context, nobody's watching. The public doesn't know what's going on in prisons. In these super maximum prisons, the guards have exactly the power over the prisoners that the students had, but it's not just for 2 days. It goes on and on for years. And tremendous sadism and abuse develops. Also, the prisoners who are in those cells develop psychiatric problems,
including becoming violent and aggressive, which then is just turned around and put back on the prisoner to say, you are a psychopath, you are a problem, you are the bad, the extreme villain, the extreme violent one, where actually there's a huge force that's at work here, which is the conditions that the person has been put into.
People with mental illness tend to have trouble, on average, following directions and you know, falling in line socially. And what happens in prison is that they tend to get disciplinary tickets. They are found guilty of infractions, and they're punished with time in solitary confinement.
Which is just exactly what we see with the police response on the street. If someone is acting in a strange way or doing something that's different, or they seem distressed, the police show up on the scene. They expect the person to, like you say, follow orders and comply, but they don't. And then the police respond by escalating violence against the person, even if they aren't violent to begin with.
Absolutely. And it's just a seamless line from that to the prison. It is the same phenomena. And so people with mental illness, prison staff are not trained to deal with people with mental illness, so they tend to identify them as behaving badly. There was some research. Irving Goffman wrote a book, Asylum, in the 50s, which was about the old Snake Pit Mental Hospital. And he described a scenario where someone gets brought to the hospital against their will, for instance, a young adult brought by their parents. They're protesting. They don't think they should be taken to the hospital. At the hospital, the staff sees them protesting. They see that they're angry, that they don't want to be there, that they're less than cooperative, and they say, the parents are right, or the referring psychiatrist is right. This person is abnormal psychologically. He's disturbed. So they diagnose him at the admission area, and they admit him to the ward. When he gets to the ward, people tell him what to do. No one listens to what he wants to do. His clothes are taken away. He's given no way to express himself. He gets angry, and for instance, he throws something at somebody. And they say, we were correct to admit him to the hospital. He is crazy. We're going to lock him in a room. They put him in a room by himself. He's idle in a seclusion room. He starts acting more and more bizarrely and eventually, for instance, uses feces to write on the wall. And what Irving Goffman said is that the system is systematically taking away every last bit of self-expression from the individual, and the individual becomes more and more extreme in their attempt to express themselves. Well, that was the snake pit of the 1940s and 1950s. I think the same thing is going on in our prisons, and the place we see it is in the supermax, where people are cutting themselves, people are screaming in the middle of the night, people are actually smearing feces on the walls. The public doesn't hear about this because the prison system has systematically made it impossible or nearly impossible to visit prisoners, and they get totally cut off from the community at large. So what we have in the prisons is a snake pit, very much like what was exposed in the 40s and the 50s, going on, and no one's aware of it.
And unfortunately, there's a very popular understanding of this is, oh, well, these are the mentally ill patients, and therefore they need medications. And so we're not actually looking at how the conditions are, as you describe, creating a very kind of understandable response of people becoming more and more extreme in their behavior. And I think one of the dangers of a lot of the discussion about mental health in prisons is that the whole context of prisons creating stress, trauma, and madness that you're describing so well, that gets taken out of the discussion. And then we get into a situation where potentially, and I'm definitely pro-choice when it comes to medication, it's not a question of being anti-medication, but we're getting into a situation where, just like the foster care system and the nursing home system, medications can be used just to kind of tranquilize and control prisoners rather than looking at the actual context that's leading to this distress and causing these kinds of traumatized responses. And one of the things that you wrote in one of your essays is that psychiatric medications don't even really work or become helpful at all if the person is in a cell and they're isolated. You mentioned that sometimes people have psychiatric interviews in these supermax prisons through the door, so there's absolutely no confidentiality. I mean, how are you supposed to get psychological help and treatment without in those kinds of conditions? So there's this failure to look at the prison system itself as a big part of the problem.
People have talked about sensory deprivation in these supermax units. It's not actually sensory deprivation because there's loud noises all the time. The slamming of doors, screaming, officers barking orders, that's going on around the clock. We have actually, this is an aside, but we've actually won class action litigation in many states barring the state from putting people with mental illness in these segregation units. This gets back to the point you made about medications. If you put someone in an extremely toxic situation, for instance, you torture them, or you put them in a segregation cell that's going to drive them mad, then giving them medications is superfluous. Actually, I think it's collusion in the inappropriate human rights abuse. So that what's happening is people are put in these cells, they go crazy, and then the psychiatrist comes along and, as you say, without a confidential setting, just right through the bars or the steel door, yells, "Are you hearing voices?" If the person is foolish enough to say, "Yes, they do," then they're going to prescribe medication for them. Well, the medication will not touch the level of stress that they're under, and it won't help their mental illness. But what will happen is that everybody will walk away satisfied that they've done proper mental health treatment, which is just absolutely not true.
So a lot of the calls for more mental health treatment in prisons, that's really what we're talking about. I mean, I imagine for some of those prisoners, the idea of getting a tranquilizer that's going to help them sleep or help calm them down in those kinds of conditions, yeah, that would be a fairly desirable kind of option given what's available to them.
That's right. But that's the key word is option. What are their options? If you're alone in a cell with nothing to do and it's driving you crazy or making you rageful, which is another reaction, or making you depressed and isolative, then the tranquilizer is an option, but it's not a very good option. By the way, I never answered your sleep question, yes, sleeping in these situations is extremely problematic, particularly when someone is up all night screaming. And for instance, people with mania who are not treated adequately are in these units and they're up all night screaming, then the other prisoners cannot get any sleep. And deprivation of sleep really makes every condition worse. We have some very good research about recidivism and about people coming out of prison and what helps them to do well. And the two things that help the most are quality contact with loved ones throughout a prison term, and that requires quality visiting, and educational programs. Any prisoner who takes part in an education program is more likely to do well after they're released. Prison systems make visiting impossible. Think about where the prisons are. They're very far from the urban centers where most of the prisoners, particularly prisoners of color, come from. So in California, the Pelican Bay State Prison I mentioned, which is a supermax isolation prison, is at the northernmost part of the state. Most of the prisoners there come from Los Angeles, in East Los Angeles. Latino prisoners are selectively placed there. So it's almost impossible for their family to get to see them. The state doesn't help at all. I mean, if my recommendations were followed, they would supply buses to bring family to see prisoners, because you want to foster a social contact between intimates while they do their prison term so that they'll have more of a chance to succeed when they leave prison. Quite the opposite is done, and prisoners are harassed, they're searched, often in extremely abusive ways. They're otherwise disinclined to come and visit because of the way they're met at the prison, the limitations to visit, and any prisoner who's in any form of segregation does not get a contact visit. Rather, they have to see their visitor through a Lexan glass window, which just makes it extremely alienating.
So it really feels like there's a strong connection here of racial prejudice and racial fears around crime and violence and people of color converging to drive this very punitive criminal justice policy that we're now seeing so disastrously play out in our prison system.
That's absolutely right, and I totally agree with you. The crime is the new face of racism. Since the civil rights movement, we have an African-American president. It's basically not okay to be overtly bigoted, but the specter of a criminal. But the truth is that 75% of people going to prison today convicted of a felony have not been convicted of a violent crime. So what they're doing is taking one extraordinary, exceptional case and using that to justify extremely harsh sentencing, extremely harsh prison conditions, a really not caring attitude towards prisoners. And it's a very foolhardy strategy, because what happens is that most people who go to prison do get out of prison. And if you're harsh and brutalize them while they're in corrections, they're going to fail when they get out, because they won't have been helped to gain the skills they need to make it in the community. People with mental illness, that's especially true. They need psychiatric rehabilitation, they need vocational training, education, they need help with socialization. In the prisons, we have to undo what we've been doing for 30 years. We have to stop crowding the prisons, stop sending low-level substance abuse offenders to prison. We have to drastically change the sentencing guidelines so that can happen. Uncrowd our prisons, put rehabilitation back together. And then in the cases of people who need to be in prison, they need to be given humane treatment that's aimed at helping them fix what's wrong with them that got them into so much trouble. I'll mention a couple of successful experiments. One is Grendon Prison, which is in England. There is a collaboration with Tavistock Institute, which is a psychoanalytic public health service clinic. And what they do is therapeutic communities where they help the prisoners meet together and make decisions for themselves rather than being told what to do every minute of every day. And those prisoners, they're randomly selected for Grendon, but they have a much lower violence rate and infraction rate while they're in prison. And when they get out, they have a much higher rate of succeeding.
Terry Coopers, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you, Will. This was an excellent interview, and I appreciate you having me on the show.
You've been listening to an interview with Terry Coopers. Terry is a professor at the Wright Institute. He's a psychiatrist in Oakland, California, and the author of 4 books, including Prison Madness, The Mental Health Crisis Behind Bars, and What We Must Do About It. Terry is an expert witness in class action litigation around prison conditions, including the sexual abuse of prisoners and prison mental health. That's about all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks a lot for tuning in. Portland Hearing Voices is an education and support community for people diagnosed with bipolar, schizophrenia, psychosis, and any extreme state of consciousness. We offer regular support groups, public events, resource referrals, and holistic mental health education. Embrace mental diversity and see madness in a new way. Check out PortlandHearingVoices.net.
The time is 11:59. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, June 1st, 2015. Portland City Commissioner Nick Fish will introduce a measure on Wednesday to establish the Portland Utility Board to replace the existing Public Utility Review Board and the Individual Utility Budget Advisory Committees. The board would provide input on utility bureau budgets, capital spending, policies, and programs. That will be discussed at this Wednesday's City Council meeting in Portland. In other City Council news, the mayor's proposed budget includes a 7% rate hike for water in Portland, in part to cover the costs of covering and demolishing city reservoirs, despite overwhelming public opposition to that plan. The budget is scheduled to be adopted on June 18th. In national news, Senate Republicans have agreed to begin debate on a House bill that would overhaul the National Security Agency's handling of American calling records while preserving other domestic surveillance provisions. That agreement did not happen soon enough to prevent the laws governing the programs from expiring at midnight Sunday, as Republican Senator Rand Paul stood in the way of extending the program. The Senate vote on the measure, known as the USA Freedom Act, will come no earlier than 1 a.m. on Tuesday. The proposed revision to the USA Patriot Act will continue to allow the FBI, NSA, and other intelligence agencies to collect private information about Americans who are under no suspicion of crime. There's also no provision in the so-called USA Freedom Act, promoted by Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, to ask the executive branch for a full accounting of all surveillance programs the intelligence agencies are using to gather information about innocent Americans.